Good morning. Democratic Congressman Jason Crow of Colorado questioned the intelligence officials who discussed a military operation in a group chat. How seriously does he think the administration is taking national security? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Vietnam's economy is booming after tariffs in Trump's first term shifted manufacturing out of China. I'm Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Now it has one of the biggest trade surpluses with the U.S., which is putting a target on its back for a new round of tariffs. Also, we speak with a lawyer for one of the Venezuelans deported to an El Salvador prison. She says a tattoo based on his favorite soccer team is being used to claim he's in a gang. It is Thursday, March 27th. On this day in 1912, First Lady Helen Taft helped plant cherry trees gifted by the mayor of Tokyo. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Congressional Democrats are demanding an official high-level investigation into top Trump officials' use of the commercial messaging app Signal. The app is not secure for classified information. Now, reporters from a German newspaper have located cell phone numbers online of some of these Trump advisors. NPR's Rob Schmitz reports.
According to an investigation by Der Spiegel, the private cell phone numbers, email addresses, and in some cases, passwords of Trump's top security advisors were found via customer data published online. Spiegel found personal contacts for National Security Advisor Mike Waltz, National Intelligence Director Tulsi Gabbard, and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. Spiegel's investigation showed that as of Wednesday, privately used and publicly searchable phone numbers belonging to Gabbard and Waltz were still linked to Signal accounts. Gabbard, Waltz, and Hegseth were among top Trump administration officials who had discussed an impending U.S. military strike against Houthi militias in Yemen in a Signal chat group last week. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Berlin.
A note, NPR CEO Catherine Marr chairs the board of the Signal Foundation. It's a nonprofit that supports the messaging app. A federal judge has blocked members of the cost-cutting entity DOGE from accessing personal data at three federal agencies. The judge ruled this violates federal privacy laws. Up until that point, NPR Stephen Fowler says one top DOGE staffer had access to all the information in all the databases.
It is normal for a small group of employees to be able to have complete access to these databases. And Trump's DOGE executive order did direct agencies to set up teams to look through the data to find, quote, waste, fraud, and abuse. But these sources are all supposed to be compartmentalized. The people who access Social Security's master beneficiary record are not the people who can see everything about student loan borrowers, are not the people who can go through the government's HR files until now.
NPR Stephen Fowler reporting. The Secretary of Homeland Security has visited a notorious maximum security prison in El Salvador. NPR's Ada Peralta reports that's where the U.S. recently deported more than 200 Venezuelans.
Federal courts are reviewing whether the Trump administration can summarily deport Venezuelans suspected of being gang members. Earlier this month, they sent more than 200 to the Secot, a prison the Salvadoran government has used to jail members of the gang MS-13. The Salvadoran government has touted the tough measures in the prison and the fact that the prisoners will never be allowed out. The Secretary of Homeland Security toured the prison but didn't talk to prisoners. At the end, she recorded a warning.
If you come to our country illegally, this is one of the consequences you could face.
Noam thanked El Salvador for jailing who she called, quote, our terrorists. Family members of some of the prisoners have said they are not gang members at all. Ada Peralta, NPR News, Mexico City.
You're listening to NPR News. The U.S. Congressional Budget Office is warning the United States will reach its debt limit as early as August. That's when the country will run out of money to pay all of its government bills. Congress and President Trump will need to reach an agreement to avert this. A bill is advancing in the Florida legislature that would remove current child labor protections for 16 and 17-year-olds. From member station WFSU, Tristan Wood reports their employers could require them to work full-time and even overnight on school days.
Supporters say the bill would allow parents and families to make decisions about their children. Critics are saying it's coming up now to make up for labor shortages in the state due to crackdowns on immigration. They're pointing to these comments Florida Governor Ron DeSantis made at an immigration roundtable last week.
Why do we say we need to import foreigners, even import them illegally, when You know, teenagers used to work at these resorts. College students should be, all this stuff.
Loosening child labor protections has become a growing trend in recent years, with over a dozen states reducing their protections. It's unclear if this bill has the votes to pass. For NPR News, I'm Tristan Wood in Tallahassee.
The rest of Major League Baseball has its opening day today. 28 of the 30 teams are in action. The league's official opening day actually started last week in Japan. That's where the Chicago Cubs and the Los Angeles Dodgers kicked off the regular 2025 season in what was called the Tokyo Series. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
You're listening to Veterans Voices, the first Gulf War.
My name's Lori Allert. I'm a retired Army nurse, attained the rank of colonel. I was in from 1984 to 1998 active, inactive from 98 to 2001, and then I went back in 2010 and retired in 2021. I was back at Fort Sam Houston for advanced officer training when Iraq invaded Kuwait. Our class was interrupted, and we were told about this unfolding event and told that in all likelihood, at some point, we would probably have to mobilize. Well, that was in the summertime in 1990, and we didn't really have any repercussions on the reserve side until shortly before the holidays, and things were beginning to ramp up, and units were being mobilized. And shortly before Christmas, the reserve unit I was with, the 44th General Hospital, was given their notice. We were given a verbal warning to be prepared. So all through Christmas, every time the phone rang, we jumped wondering if this is the call. Christmas came and went, New Year's came and went, and we were like, to the point of, can we just get this over with? And shortly after New Year's, we got the call saying, this is it, report to home station, you're being mobilized.
Veterans Voices, The First Gulf War, is produced by AMPRS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, and is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. In a few minutes, we'll ask how President Trump's tariffs on car imports could affect car prices. But first, did officials in the Trump administration put national security at risk when they communicated war plans over Signal? Lawmakers on the Hill have been grilling top intelligence officials about that for 2 days now. That's after the Atlantic magazine revealed this week that members of the Trump administration inadvertently included the magazine's editor, Jeffrey Goldberg, in a group chat discussing a bombing campaign in Yemen. Here is Congressman Jason Crow, a Democrat from Colorado, and the House Intelligence Committee hearing yesterday.
Director Gabbard, have the Houthis indicated an ability to shoot down American aircraft?
Yes.
They have in fact done so, haven't they?
Yes.
Including MQ-9 Reapers, haven't they?
That's correct.
And that was one of the systems used in the attack recently that's the subject of this discussion, is it not?
Correct.
I want to mention here that Congressman Crow also served as an Army Ranger in Iraq and Afghanistan, and he's with us now to tell us more about his thoughts about this. Good morning, Congressman.
Good morning.
So I want to draw on that experience as a person who served in the military in volatile environments overseas. What was the risk of communicating sensitive military information using Signal?
Well, the most important thing when you're conducting an operation is the element of surprise, right? The adversary cannot know you're coming because they, of course, can prepare for that. The risk goes up exponentially, and you know, people can die. It's not hyperbole to say that if the adversary knows that you're coming, the risk of casualties goes up tremendously. So that's what we're talking about here. And with the Houthis, we're talking about a very sophisticated military force. This isn't a bunch of people rolling around in the back of pickup trucks with AK-47s. They have some of the most sophisticated weapon systems in the world, thanks to the Russians and others. And we have to be very careful when we're dealing with that.
So you've been calling for Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth to resign. Why him and why not Mike Waltz, who says that he is the one who created the group chat? And what do you think that would accomplish?
Well, Secretary Hegseth is the one who has executive authority over our nation's largest agency, you know, the agency that's charged with protecting our country, right? And I said from day one that Pete Hegseth is not qualified for this job. He doesn't have any experience working at a high level in national security. He has no experience running large organizations. And you see what happens now when you have somebody without the experience and expertise to handle sensitive matters. What happens is they act in a careless and reckless way. He doesn't take it seriously. And the risk for our men and women in uniform is very high as a result of that.
So at the moment, Defense Secretary Hegseth doesn't seem inclined to resign, and the president doesn't seem inclined to ask him to or require him to. So what do you believe this administration should do now to show that it's taking this matter seriously?
Well, just because they won't enforce standards and they don't hold themselves to the same standards as they expect of everyone else doesn't mean that we should get rid of our standards, right? I mean, if this had happened to a private, to a sergeant, to a general, anybody who I served with and anybody below the chain of command from Pete Hegseth, those folks would have instantly been investigated, probably relieved of command or responsibility, and potentially even court-martialed. So what the Trump administration is saying is, you know what, the people at the top, they run by different rules. They're protected and the rules don't apply to them, which of course sends a message that, you know, culture is dysfunctional and sends a message down the chain of command that these things don't matter. So that's where things start deteriorating within organizations, and that's where people end up getting killed. So I'm not going to allow the lack of standards of the Trump administration to dictate what I do and don't do. I'm going to just call it like I see it, and I'm going to say that people should resign if they mess up at this level.
So to that end, Republicans attacked former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server for years, even though there's no evidence that it was ever compromised. But now it seems that Democrats, mainly Democrats, some Republicans, but mainly Democrats are gearing up to, as you just said, to keep talking about this and to continue to attack these officials for their use of Signal. Is there a way to avoid this becoming just another political football and really reemphasize security best practices?
Yeah, of course. I mean, we're not going to wrestle with the pig and get muddy here. What we're going to do is actually just talk about the facts. We're not going to play the political theater that the Trump administration and the people closest to Trump always play. We're just going to explain in very common terms what's happening here and why this is important, why the culture of recklessness and carelessness at the very top within the Trump administration is putting the lives of our men and women at stake, and why that has to change, and why that is important to American people, and why they should, frankly, be extremely upset about it.
That is Congressman Jason Crow. He is a Democrat from Colorado, and he sits on the House Intelligence and Armed Services Committees. And as we said, he's a combat veteran. Congressman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Morning Edition reached out to Republican lawmakers, representatives for the White House, and every Trump administration official who was in the Signal chat group. All either declined or did not respond to our requests for interviews. And I also want to note that NPR CEO Catherine Marr chairs the board of the nonprofit Signal Foundation.
President Trump announced that he's imposing a 25% tariff on all car imports.
He says the money collected will boost government revenues and encourage automakers to build cars and parts in the U.S. rather than import them.
I think our automobile business will flourish like it's never flourished before.
But auto service providers like Cox Automotive estimate that that could add thousands of dollars to car prices if the tariffs go through. And stocks of automakers declined in the hours before the announcement, underscoring the uncertainty Trump's trade policy is having on markets.
NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez is here to tell us all about this. So, Franco, let's start off with the goals of these tariffs and the concerns they're raising.
Yeah, Trump says these tariffs will go into effect next week. Now, they apply to both autos and auto parts. Trump is kind of painting this as a way to jumpstart the auto industry and raise tens of billions of dollars in revenue. He says auto companies, even foreign ones, will build more operations in the U.S. or expand existing ones. And he's criticized those who took operations in the past out of the U.S.
So we'll effectively be charging a 25% tariff. But if you build your car in the United States, there is no tariff. And what that means is a lot of foreign car companies, a lot of companies are going to be in great shape because they've already built their plant, but their plants are underutilized, so they'll be able to expand them inexpensively and quickly.
But as Michelle noted, the move is also raising a lot of concerns.
Ooh, let's talk about those concerns. Who are the winners and the losers here?
Well, one of the big winners are the auto unions. The United Auto Workers Union, for example, is praising this decision, saying it's time to, quote, end the free trade disaster. But the big three automakers, Ford, General Motors, and Stellantis, are very concerned. You know, they have production spread out across the world, including Canada and Mexico. And the cars and the parts are going to be tariffed. You know, they've raised big concerns in the past when these threats were posed. And a group that represents foreign automakers like BMW, Honda, has also raised concerns that it's all just going to make it more expensive to produce cars and lead to higher prices.
So how do these fit into Trump's larger trade policy?
Yeah, Trump's already imposed a bunch of other tariffs on steel and aluminum, as well as other goods from China, Canada, and Mexico. And these new tariffs come just a week ahead of his promised announcement of reciprocal tariffs on imports, which he says are, you know, for those countries that impose tariffs on the U.S. But he did yesterday back off a bit on how tough those reciprocal tariffs will be. Yesterday, he said people may be surprised that they're going to be more lenient than they once feared. He also did say, though, to expect tariffs on lumber and pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, you know, it does seem like President Trump loves tariffs or even the threat of tariffs. Economists don't seem to share that view. How do you square those two things?
Yeah, he really does love tariffs. He says that all the time. I mean, he argues that they're an important tool to be used for leverage on things like national security and other U.S. interests. But you're absolutely right. Most economists say tariffs raise prices for consumers, and that could hurt the economy. Trump often uses them as a negotiating tool, and that has really made economists even more worried. And that's because of the uncertainty that they cause, and you see that in the markets. Now, in some cases, he says these tariffs will go away if countries do things that he wants, like help him with immigration. But this time, he says he's serious and that these car tariffs are here to stay.
All right, we'll see. That's NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
This year's Grammy winner for Best New Artist, Chapel Roan, is a certified pop music star. But the Midwest princess, as she is known, decided to head south on a new country-infused single. The question is, will country radio embrace it? Here's Hazel Sills from NPR Music.
Chapel Roan originally premiered her song, The Giver, on Saturday Night Live last November, and she'd been teasing its release for weeks. Now that it's finally out, the song debuted at number 5 on Billboard's main pop chart. Of course, she's no stranger to that chart. The big question is, what happened on the country charts? Despite this being a loud and proud, fiddle-driven track, it doesn't quite fit the blueprint of a typical mainstream country hit, given Roan's total absence from the genre before now and the song's cheeky, queer messaging. Nonetheless, The Giver did debut at number 1 on the Hot Country Songs chart. You ain't gotta tell me, it's just in my nature. So take it like a taker. So baby, I'm a giver. Now, this needs some explaining. In 2012, Billboard changed how the charts data is measured. It previously only counted radio play on country format stations. That was changed to include stations across genres. The move was controversial because it meant that pop artists who make crossover country songs, like Beyoncé and Post Malone, would be favored. Billboard also has a separate country airplay chart, and the discrepancies have been clearer ever since. For example, Taylor Swift's sort of pop, sort of country hit, We Are Never Ever Getting Back Together, spent 10 weeks at number 1 on the Hot Country Songs chart, despite only peaking at 13 on the country airplay chart back in 2012. Chapel Roan may be number 1 this week on Hot Country Songs, but she's not even in the top 50 of country airplay. Roan may be a giver, but it remains to be seen if country radio will be a taker. Hazel Sills, NPR Music. She gets the job
done. This is NPR News.
It is 6:19. You're listening into the Thursday morning show. This is member supported KAXE. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. I'm Heidi Holton. Thanks for tuning in. Coming up, we talk fishing. If you have a question for Jeff Sundin, our early bird fishing guide, you can text us at 218-326-1234. We've been talking signs of spring all week. It is our question of the week. And we heard from someone yesterday who said, at the mouth of the Turtle River as it enters frozen Turtle River Lake, I love watching all the waterfowl gathering in the slow currents entering the frozen lake. I love riding my fat bike on the frozen spring lakes and noticing all the springs along the shoreline, the smells of alder and trees waking up in the sun. And Monica, thank you, Monica. She sent in that text today. We'd love to hear from you, 218-326-1234. Support for programming comes from you, our listeners, as well as the Judy Garland Museum, located in Highway 169 in Grand Rapids, featuring Judy Garland's 1920s childhood home and a gallery of Judy and Wizard of Oz memorabilia, including the original carriage from the film. Visitor information available, judygarlandmuseum.com. We are at, in northeastern Minnesota, could be at critical fire weather conditions this afternoon with high humidity. Expecting sunny skies across the region, highs 47 to 55. Increasing clouds into this evening with lows 29 to 36. East winds 5 to 10, gusting up to 20. Tomorrow, Friday, looks like we could see some weather moving in. Rain or freezing rain is likely. Highs in the upper 30s to low 40s for most of the area, with highs near 50 in the Brainerd area. Breezy east winds gusting up to 20, and evening lows in the mid to upper 20s.
Gone fishing. There's a sign upon your door.
Pops, don't blab it around, will you?
Gone fishing.
Keep it shady. I got me a big one staked out.
You ain't working anymore.
I don't have to work. I got me a piece of Gary.
Cows need milking in the barn.
I have the twins on that detail. They each take a side.
But you just don't give a darn.
Give them 4 bits of cow and hand lotion.
You just never seem to learn.
Man, you taught me.
You ain't got no ambition.
You're convincing me.
Gone fishing. Got your hound dog by your side.
That's old Cindy Lou going with me.
Gone fishing. Fleas are biting at his hide.
Get away from me, boys. You're bothering me. Folks won't find us now because Mr. Satch and Mr. Cross, we gone fishing. Instead of just a wishing.
Bumpo, baby, bumpo, 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 then.
Oh, yeah.
It is time to check in with Jeff Sundin, our early bird fishing guide. Well, good morning, Jeff. Thanks for being here.
You bet. Thank you.
Well, okay, so this is pretty interesting. You are telling me that I could be fishing for walleyes or crappies, and I could do that from the boat or from the ice this weekend in the state of Minnesota.
All depends on how you want to do it. Whatever the mood is, you can figure out a way to get there from here. The I guess the breaking news, quote unquote, the no pun intended, but the Rainy River was starting to open up a little bit. And the folks up in Coochaching County, they're kind of generous when it comes to making sure that people can get on that river to go fishing. So they show up with the heavy equipment early in the spring, and they start to break those ice chunks away from the landing area at the ramp. And they were out doing that yesterday. The Royal Dutchman Resort has been posting some videos. if you want to now. I don't know that I would say this is going to be the weekend where you get the 2,000 people all at once up there, but the early arrivers are already starting to show up. There's a couple of photos on Facebook from Royal Dutchman that there's folks that are fishing on the river right now, and that usually is about all the news that you have to get before the rest of everybody else to show up. So it's not widespread. You haven't got the entire stretch of river from Birchdale all the way down to the lake opened up. There's a lot of that that's still frozen, but the first little stretch. It seems like once that opens up and once you get some traffic on that first stretch of the river, maybe every 2 or 3 days you'll see it advance down to as far as the next available landing. And so that's on the schedule. And then if you really don't care about that and you just as soon go someplace where everything's open already, the folks over on the western border, Traverse Lake, Big Stone Lake, those are wide open. Everything is open there, and I've been watching some announcements as they put in not every one of the landings and not every little park, but a good number of them now have got all of the docks in and the facilities are up and running and open. So if folks that like to fish on that South Dakota-Minnesota border water, this is going to be, I'm sure, a big weekend for them because that walleye fishing season is open year-round over there. So another place where you can go and wet a line if you want to and catch some walleyes. You may stumble into a pretty decent perch out there from time to time, too. They have been known for a really good perch fishery. This winter, the ice fishing wasn't fabulous. So I'm not too sure whether the spring will be great or not, but those are just like walleyes. The walleyes are making their move towards the spawning territory, and the perch are kind of right behind them, nipping at their heels the whole way. So once the walleye bite starts up, you're looking at perch that are in the pre-spawn mode, and it'll be a pretty good bite for a little while. Once they start to spawn, they get a little hard to catch, and it's not as much fun, but for the first 10, 12 days of the season, it's pretty good. So something to look forward to. And one more place, if you're interested in boat fishing south of a line, let's just say from Mankato running eastward towards Lake Pepin, most of the lakes down in that region are open now. You could put a boat in if you want to do some crappie fishing or panfish, sunfish. You can pretty much find a place to fish almost in every county down in that southern third or so of the state of Minnesota. So that gives you some ideas about what to do with open water. But if you want to, if you'd rather just go ice fishing some more, you can do that. I got a really glowing report just yesterday from a neighbor who had kind of snuck back in the back door with some information about some friends of his that had been fishing right here in Itasca County and doing a really nice job catching crappies. They're still going out. There's plenty of ice. They're still going out using ATVs. And like we talked about last weekend, the only thing that could interrupt your travel are the really popular lakes that have got heavy traffic at the landings. Just the landing itself may be going bad in some places, but if you want to find a place to fish, the art of getting out on the lakes is just to go up the shore a little ways, find yourself a place where there hasn't been too much traffic, and you should be able to find a way out. Or, when possible, do like I do and just find a little place to walk out and enjoy all that without having to carry all the big artillery with you. Just take a bucket with a few poles and sit on the ice. That's really nice this time of year.
Yeah, it was
the other big.
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was traveling Highway 2 from Bemidji to Grand Rapids yesterday, and open water under the bridge to Cass Lake. But then, you know, a handful, maybe 10 people out fishing on, you know, just sitting on chairs and buckets out, you know, a ways from that water, but people seem to be having fun.
Yep. It's always kind of interesting to square that image up in your mind, there can be open water someplace and then enough to support 10 or 12 people. And of course, the longer we wait, the less likely that scenario is going to be. But for this weekend, we really had a week worth of pretty cold weather. So you get these nights where everything freezes back solid again, and then it takes until mid-afternoon before things start to thaw out the next day. And without any snow to melt on the surface of the ice, it stays dry. And the one hazard, you have to make sure you've got cleats with you, because the surface can get kind of slippery and cleats are an essential item. So, but the, at least for the rest of this weekend, I think we've got pretty smooth sailing. Itasca County, North Central Minnesota. The pike we talked about last week up on Lake of the Woods, that has been going really strong throughout this entire week. And especially folks that are fishing around from Zippel Bay on to the west towards Rocky Point, people that are fishing in that stretch of water there are catching some monster-sized northern pike right now. If that's something you've never really done before, it can be awful fun. I would suggest probably get in touch with the folks either at Zippel Bay Resort or contact Arneson's over at Rocky Point. Those are the two kind of main headquarters where folks are still doing this, and you should be able to find a way to get out and pursue these pike. It doesn't take a lot of gear. A tip-up, one of the probably the more fun ways to do it for each person in the group, let's say you go with three people, you put out three tip-ups that are spaced out maybe 50 feet or 100 feet away from each other, so everybody's got a tip-up to watch, and you stay close to that so that you're nice and legal all the time. And then somewhere close by, drill another hole, and if you've got any kind of a heavy action-type ice fishing rod, something that may be suitable for lake trout or heavy, you know, not a panfish rod. You want something with a little backbone to it. And egg sinker, it's pretty common now. You can walk into most of the sporting goods stores and find these double hook rigs. They've got a couple of spinner blades on them and some beads and a couple of treble hooks, and you can rig this up to run on an ice fishing rod. The one set of hooks goes towards the head of your minnow, another one towards the tail end, and not a lot of action. You can kind of pump it in the water or whatever. And if you've ever had a big northern pike come up and grab a 8 or 9 inch sucker minnow and start taking off with it, it's pretty exhilarating. You don't catch 20 fish in a day typically, but if you get two or three bites and the smallest fish is 15 pounds, it can be pretty exciting. And I'm seeing fish that they're measuring at 40 inches to up to one. I saw one image of a 44 incher that was caught a couple days ago over at Arneson's. That's a pretty big northern pike. A lot of people fish a long time between seeing fish like that. And this is one time of the year where you could do it repeatedly.
All right, let's move on to another story. We talk often about forward-facing sonar. Now the Minnesota Muskie and Pike Alliance are making a big push to do something about it to the DNR.
Yeah, this is getting to be the conversation on the forward sonar in muskie and pike fishing circles. This is getting to be a big deal. To try and make this go as quickly as I possibly can, they've been discussing this for a while now. They just put out an information packet, and it's going to be, I'm sure, presented today at the MinFish Summit and again this weekend coming up. But it's about 12 pages, 10 or 12 pages of different cause and effect, you know, what they see happening out there. Now, this is all anecdotal. The problem that you have, people like us, we go out and fish, we see what we see, and we interpret it the way we interpret it. We don't really know scientifically how close we are to the exact reason things are happening. But let me just say that if you go out on a lake where you've never seen a dead muskie in your life, you've been fishing there for 25 or 30 years, and all of a sudden you see people targeting individual fish that are out in 30 and 40 and 50 feet of water, places where we never could catch those fish before, you see them being caught, and then you also see dead fish floating on the surface of the lake. It gets your attention, and people tend to get kind of heated up about this because they're seeing the muskie fishing decline in a lot of the more popular lakes, and we have quite a few of those right here in Itasca County. Cass County has got a lot of them, Beltrami County, where the fish that we used to, me growing up, a muskie or a gigantic northern pike was a fish that lived in the weeds or by the bulrushes or a rock pile. At least that's always been our conception. But the truth of the matter is those fish are only in those locations when they're resting. That's not where they want to be. They're just there. They're taking it easy, resting. And we have access to them. We can see the structure, and it makes it easier for us to fish for them. So through the years, that's been the common way to pursue them. But when those fish are on the prowl and when they're really feeding, they're out in the middle of the lake looking for, depending on what's in that lake, it could be tulabies, it could be whitefish, it could be smelt in the case of Pokegama, for example. But the deep water, open kind of forage that just roams around in the center of the lake when you go on a feeding run, never before in history have we been able to say, okay, let's go out in 40 feet of water until we see a fish and then fish for it until we finally catch it. And that's what the forward sonar is allowing these folks to do. So if you think about it, a fish like a crappie where there might be 500 fish in a school, it's not that big of a deal if you take 10 crappies out of that school. But if you're going and singling out one individual fish, you can see the fish, you know what it is, you target the fish with a lure, you watch his behavior, you see if he's going to bite or not, and you get to the point where it's almost so efficient that the fish don't stand a chance. And so, like I say, the conversation is getting very interesting. It's getting harder all the time for me to encounter somebody that doesn't have a strong opinion one way or the other. So this is going to be something to watch, and obviously, it's going to be on the agenda today. I've been doing my best to make sure everybody knows what's happening with these fishery summits that are happening this week. So there was one more link that they put out yesterday, the one that I sent you. They just made a last-minute announcement. Somebody from Bemidji has offered to live stream this event today. And the folks that can't come, I understand that they still have some space available. They've been putting out little promos for it throughout the whole week. You could still attend it in person if you want to right here in Grand Rapids. Registration opens at 9 o'clock, so it's kind of a last-minute thing now. But if you can't make it at all, there is a link that you can click on it and get into the live streaming of it. I've sent the copy to you of that, and I'll put one on the website as soon as we're done talking here, so
okay,
we can follow that and get on to that.
Yeah, if folks are interested in that, you can also text me this morning at 218-326-1234. It's also something going on, so the Minnesota Fish Summit today in Grand Rapids and live streaming, and then the Minnesota DNR Fisheries Summit will be at Central Lakes College in Brainerd on Saturday.
Yep, and that's another one that I'll be in. The two meetings will be kind of similar discussions. I think whatever we hear today at the MinFish Summit is going to get carried over into that the DNR, the official annual fishery summit. And they have been recruiting. They're looking for people to comment. If you were to check the fishing report yesterday, I'd already put up links for that for public commentary questions. And in particular, there's going to be a panel discussion at the end of that session on Saturday, and it's going to all revolve around the technology part of things. So if you've got questions or comments on that, which I'm sure folks do, there's only one way to say this. It's not the polite way to say it, but if you have an opinion and you don't think anybody knows what it is, it's your own fault now, because there's five or six different ways to express your opinion right now this morning and get it in front of everybody from the fisheries chief to the governor. So this is your chance to speak up if you've got something to say.
Sounds Sounds like you can find the links at Jeff's website at jeffsundin.com. You're going to be busy for the next couple of days. I look forward to hearing about it next week.
Sounds like a plan.
All right. Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks. We'll see you.
See ya. That's the Early Bird Fishing Guide, Jeff Sundin. If you'd like a link to that live streaming of this MN Fish Summit today, text me at 218-326-1234. I'm Heidi Holton. Coming up, we've got National Native News. We're learning about Native American students that make up 11% of public school enrollment in New Mexico, but there are not enough resources for them to learn their native languages. Stay tuned for that story. We've got the set list coming from Malachi Coons, live music in our region, and local news from our region with the Up North Report coming up a little bit after 7 o'clock. Support for KEXE comes from Grande Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at grandeitasca.org.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A bill to create tribal language immersion schools passed in the recent New Mexico legislative session, as Jeanette Didios reports.
New Mexico has 23 sovereign tribes, and among those tribes, 8 languages are spoken, but only 7 are taught in school districts. Senate Bill 13 would create a 5-year pilot program with 5 schools prioritizing distinct native languages of Tiwa, Tewa, Toa, Karis, Apache, Zuni, and Diné. Bill co-sponsor Democratic Senator Benny Shendo Jr. from Jemez Pueblo says that many Native parents and grandparents have been conditioned to believe that the only way to succeed was to speak English.
But that's not true. I was born and raised speaking my own language. It wasn't much later that I began to learn English. So how can that be when those of us that were fluent Native speakers are able to be successful in college and all the stuff that we're doing today?
He says a lot of Native students are struggling because they don't feel that they belong.
And if we can really reground them in who they are, then I think it gives them that confidence for them to be able to go out and compete in the world in a way that they should be competing, not with anxiety about who am I, where do I belong.
Native American students have historically reported lower achievement and graduation rates than their peers. The New Mexico Indian Education Act stresses the importance of maintaining Native languages and culture, but programs providing these opportunities are currently limited within public schools. The bill does not contain an appropriation, but will provide operational and capital outlay funding for immersion schools. For National Native News, I'm Jeanette Didios.
A new study shows intimate partner violence disproportionately impacts Indigenous women more than any other ethnic or racial group in the U.S. Judith Ruiz Branch has more.
The murder rate for Native American women and girls is up to 10 times higher than the national average, according to the U.S. Department of Justice, yet they account for less than 1% of the population. Desiree Todi with the Center Against Sexual and Domestic Abuse is a member of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa in Wisconsin. She says violence against Native women is underreported and unaddressed.
There's jurisdictional issues that come into play as to how things are investigated, how things are tried, and there's always racism. There's less attention paid to the individuals that some of these things happen to.
The Wisconsin Department of Justice created a task force to combat violence against Native women across the state after legislation that would have addressed these issues failed to pass. Poor tracking and data collection are just some of the many issues that contribute to the epidemic amongst Indigenous women. During a multi-state march last month, Todi read a list of names of Indigenous people from Minnesota who had died from domestic violence. No such list currently exists for Wisconsin, and Todi says she's working on changing that. She emphasizes the great need to address the systems in place that continue to fail Native people.
I have 3 daughters that I want them to grow up as strong Native women, and I want them to grow up safely as strong Native women. I mean, this is their futures on the line.
Research shows Indigenous women also face significant barriers when seeking help after experiencing domestic violence. A survivor herself, Todi works to provide resources for those affected in Bayfield and Ashland counties. I'm Judith Ruiz Branch reporting.
Tribal flags removed from a Veterans Affairs hospital in Phoenix, Arizona, are now being displayed by the office of Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs. The flags were removed after new rules were issued by the Trump administration on the public display of flags throughout VA facilities. Tribal leaders in the state strongly objected to the removal of the flags by the VA. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Since 1976, KAXE has been people-powered radio, telling the stories of the people and the land of northern Minnesota. We are not media that is corporately owned. We are fueled by you, with local business support, volunteer-hosted programs, and members who keep our focus on what matters most, our community.
Scott, why do you support KAXE?
I think that no matter what kind of program you guys do, how slick your production values get, whatever the thing does, you never lose sight of where it started and why it's there, and that's the community. And I think that's the way we hang in there with you.
You can keep people-powered radio going strong for northern Minnesota. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. I'm Heidi Holton. I've been on the airwaves for about 25 years at KAXE, and now more than ever, I can't thank you enough.
One day I know I feel home again, wrong again, wrong again. One day I know I feel strong again, I lift my head. Many times I've been told, all this talk will make you. So I'll close my eyes, look behind, moving on, moving on. So I'll close my eyes, look behind, moving on. Lost again, lost. One day I know our paths will cross again. Smile again, smile again. One day I hope to make you smile again. I won't hide. Many times I've been told, speaking my just be. So I'll close my eyes, won't look behind, moving on, moving on. So I'll close my eyes, and the tears will clear. Then I'd feel no fear. Then I'd feel no way, my paths will be made. Home again, home again. One day I know I feel home again. Wrong again, wrong again. One day I know I feel strong again. Lift my head. Many times I've been told, all this talk will make you fall. So I'll close my eyes, won't look behind, moving on, moving on. So I'll close my eyes. Look behind, moving on.
Oh, Michael Kiwanuka, to get us going on this Thursday morning. The song is called Home Again.
It's 6:49, and this is the Thursday Morning Show. This is People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. I'm Heidi Holton, and sitting in for Kari Hedlund is Sarah Bignall. Welcome, Sarah.
Hey, good morning.
It's been a while.
It has been.
I mean, I see you all the time. I don't mean I don't see you, but we don't get to host the show together. So it should be a lot of fun, because later I'm going to be picking your brain on books and reading. Even if you don't like the books, I think that's useful information. And maybe we can have people help you and send you some good things.
You know, I found a series that I'm obsessed with. Mm. I've yet to find anybody else that is obsessed with the series.
Oh.
And it's to the point to where I have forced my husband to start reading the series. And he's reading the books, and I'm like,
What do you think?
Do you like it?
What is the series? This is going to be the thing of the morning. Has anyone else read these books? Here we go.
Dungeon Crawler Carl. I absolutely love the series.
Okay.
It is something that I had found while scrolling TikTok. People were like, hey, I picked up this book. I didn't know what to expect. It's not, you know, this is not what I thought would be for me. And the premise is that Earth defaulted on a loan it had thousands of years ago with a bunch of aliens, and they came to collect their debt. And so they kind of sucked all the buildings into the middle of the Earth. They start mining things, and if you were not inside a building, you were saved, but you're now forced to participate in a labyrinth and a crawl.
Oh.
And so it's this man with his ex-girlfriend's cat, Princess Donut, and and Carl and Princess Donut enter this labyrinth to essentially fight for their lives. And these are two of the most delightful characters. The book's a little vulgar.
Okay.
It's a little violent. It's very funny. It's very heartwarming.
What's the name again?
Dungeon Crawler Carl. There are 7 books.
Wow.
And I plowed through all 7 of them in a very short period of time.
You know, I haven't had it in a while, but that was a feeling in the pandemic, like when you found a series and you knew you had, you know, 11 books ahead of you.
Yeah.
That is just one of the best feelings ever, you know? So, okay, so we need to know if anyone else has read this or if you want to take it on so that Sarah can talk to you about it.
Like, just anybody.
And I can't seem to keep it in my head. What is it? Some Carl? Dungeon?
Dungeon Crawler Carl.
Dungeon Crawler Carl. Okay.
Dungeon Crawler Carl. And
did you ask Tammy or Stephanie Brady?
I did, and she was not familiar with it. Then she found some videos, and then she was here last week, and she was like, oh, I might maybe pick it up. But
what's the one you're looking for with it?
No, I just need somebody to be as enthusiastic. What I really like about it is that Carl seems like your typical kind of male main character, that he's strong and that, but he has this cat that's with him, and they have such soft, tender moments, and that he's a very kind of complex and empathetic and kind person that you often don't see in those types of roles.
Sure.
And I don't know, I absolutely love them. And I feel like I'm on my own little island.
Wow.
You know.
Is Paul liking them? Or just he's not doing it fast enough and talking to you about it enough?
So like last night, I'm like, where are you? He's like, I don't know, I'm just on chapter 2. I'm like, bah, like, read
oh
faster.
Is this one you could twist your arm of your daughter once she has some time? I mean, I know she's
Yeah, I
busy.
Think this, because it's called a lit RPG. So, you know, it has the feeling of a D&D campaign. So you have a class and race, and you're able to outfit yourself with gear and equipment. And so the characters themselves kind of level up as they're, you know, making their way through this maze, this labyrinth. So people, you know, if you like kind of fantasy things, there's also a bit of that.
What if you found out it was being made into a TV series or a movie?
So it is.
Okay.
So it has been picked up. Seth Farlin has picked it up by Fuzzy Studios is the name of his company. And then it sounds like the screenwriter from Thor Ragnarok has been tapped in to write the series. So it could be, I feel comfortable in that because Thor Ragnarok is one of my favorite, like, Marvel franchise, you know, it's just a well-written, it's very funny, like, movie.
So this is exciting.
Yeah. And then Seth Farland, because there's such a ridiculousness about this book that you need somebody who is comfortable with that kind of ridiculous. Yeah. And Seth Farland is absolutely that person that is.
Are we, is it Seth MacFarlane? Am I thinking, is he the Family Guy?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Gotcha.
Yep.
I know who you're talking about. Hey, we heard from Mary from Cass Lake. She's saying good morning to me and Jennifer. And then, well, good morning, Sarah. So yeah. She's good to hear. Glad to hear from you as well. We've got the set list coming up from Malachi Coons.
Oh.
And we also want to tell you about the weather. We may see some snow and rain coming in. Today is possible near critical fire weather conditions for portions of northeast Minnesota. Yeah. Keep that in mind. And we'll see temperatures upper 40s to mid 50s, but rain or freezing rain likely for tomorrow and into the evening, and a slight chance of snow on Saturday. This, I don't know. We're feeling like we were going to have our nephew come from Duluth last weekend, but it's like, oh, it's gonna be snowy. Yeah. And it wasn't really, you know, but the roads weren't great either. So
I heard Jen say yesterday that she's been appreciating the cold nights because it freezes everything. And I generally, this is usually my walk time in the morning. Yeah. And so now it means that my afternoon walk is probably going to be a little more muddy. The little bit of snow we've been getting has been providing some traction on the ice. So I've actually kind of appreciated that.
There we go.
Yeah. And you can donate your car, RV, boat to KAXE to support independent community radio. You can call us at 855-277-2346 or email Heather at KAXE.org.
This is The Set List on KAXE, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are looking at Friday and Saturday, March 28th and 29th, with shows in Aiken, Duluth, Grand Rapids, and Bemidji. First up, a duo called Sawtooth Witch will be at Sampaguita in Aiken Friday night at 6 p.m. With Pat Doc Dougherty on guitar and Haley Fleming on violin, both sharing vocals, they make acoustic dance rock and formally released music under the name They Self. The show begins at 6 p.m. It's Friday night, Sawtooth Witch at Sampaguita in Aiken. At 7:30, alt-rock singer-songwriter Mary Bew is celebrating the release of her new album at Sacred Heart Music Center in Duluth. Bew will be performing with a full band behind the new album, The Wildness of Living and Dying, which showcases her intimate and intense songwriting. Opening the show is folk singer and violinist Galen Lee. It's this Friday at Duluth at Sacred Heart. On Saturday, Lonesome Dan Case is part of a new duo playing at Rapids Brewing in Grand Rapids at 6 p.m. Kismet Rendezvous features old-timey singer Dawn Tanner alongside Lonesome Dan, playing a mix of Americana and blues. It is Saturday night in Grand Rapids. And the final featured show of the set list is jam funk band Kitschy Boogie at Headwaters Music and Arts in Bemidji. The group features Shane Corning and Jason Dowell on guitar and vocals, Doug Quance on drums, and Papa Steve Ross on bass. The show is a benefit for Headwaters Scholarship Programs, and their school band will open the evening at 6 o'clock. Kitschy Boogie at Headwaters Music and Arts this Saturday. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, and we'll post the latest edition every Wednesday at KAXE.org.
Malachi Coons and the set list. You hear it here on KAXE. And coming up, we'll have local news with the Up North Report. Later this morning, Sarah, we've got our report for Minnesota journalism students checking in with Chelsea Perkins. They are at the legislature reporting on what's going on for us, and we'll get to hear more. It's really fun to be involved with the students from the University of Minnesota Journalism School.
And when we got to meet them a couple weeks ago when Chelsea was interviewing them, what a great opportunity and what an interesting time to be covering.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
You know, nothing like trial by fire there for these young journalists. And so I'm really impressed, though, with the work that they've been putting out. So I'm excited to hear more.
Yeah, about you can also read it at our website, KAXE.org. Coming up at 9, we've got Headwaters. Malachi Coons is your host. Marie DeBrie at 1 o'clock for On the River. And Gina the Knife at 7.
o'clock. Powerhouse women today.
Yeah, great. I always like Marie's shows, and Gina has a...
Gina's going full 90s tonight, so you might want to hear
what's
going on.
Right up my alley there. I'm good. We received support from Lake Country Journal, a magazine showcasing the beauty, landscape, and people of North Country, or the Lake Country. From the March issue, publishes the winners of their annual photo contest, which are also displayed at the Brainerd Lakes Regional Airport. Submissions accepted all year round at lakecountryjournal.com.
We are still accepting submissions for our record store day. We're asking for you to dig through your crates or give us some well-loved...
But, you know...
Gently loved vinyl donations.
I like gently loved. That's yes. A good...
March, and that's just until March 28th, so till tomorrow. Drop them off at our studios in Grand Rapids or Bemidji during business hours, and then that record store day event will be at the Rail River Folk School in Bemidji, April 12th from 9 to 1.
And that sale has moved up an hour, so if you were used to kind of, I was always there at 10, it's starting at 9 o'clock.